Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! It is the 30th day of August, 2013. We find ourselves at the end of the month. And at the end of the month on Friday on the front porch. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find the Listen Live button, access to the chat room, and yes, the PayPal button, with which y'all managed to keep this whole enterprise afloat, and for which we are all of us, listener, caller, emailer, chat room chatter, me, we are all deeply, deeply grateful. The Horn is also available on a wide variety of streaming platforms, apps, and so forth, things like the TuneIn Radio app and the Stitcher Internet Radio app. We recommend both based upon your own particular choosing and tastes. For listening on your tablet, your smartphone, what have you. Podcast address is at whiterosesociety.org under the subdomain for this program. You can also get the podcast at iTunes. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It is Friday on the front porch, a time to sort of kick back and relax and put your boots up on the porch rail. Take a swig of that rocket fuel in that earthenware jug over there if you want to, or you can take the less flammable approach and just go with the sweet tea or the lemonade. Entirely a matter of your choosing. And do enjoy, please. I'm hoping we will repeat what we've done the last couple of Fridays and go to our Skype Horn Malloy chat group about the second hour. You're welcome to join in on that. If you'd like to join the Skype group, just shoot an email to me. I will send it on to Duncan, otherwise known as Sparky, our chat room moderator and Skype group moderator, who will add you into the discussion. Of course, the regular phone lines still work, 304-658-3333, and you can participate that way if you wish. So, yeah, here we are, Friday. Sorry about playing hooky last night. But at least you know I wasn't out, frittering my time away. I tweeted the link to the WCHS Fox Town Hall. And you were able to, if you wished, stream it and watch it live, and I know many of you did. And doing so, many of you saw Ferg get up and accuse the coal industry via mountaintop removal of, yes, genocide. Takes a lot of guts to say something like that to a bunch of millionaire thugs who would as soon kill you as look at you. So I was really proud of him. I was genuinely proud of him. Of course, he was later, his words were miscast by the, must be a ladder climbing foxer, the guy who stood there and, you know, talked a lot like this and sounded like he was going to sell us a top 40 package for best of the 70s. Oh, yay, yay. In the stand up that he did with the Anchor Blonde, from the Charleston station, he was from Dayton, Ohio, he said that Ferg compared mountaintop removal to the Holocaust. Liar! Liar. liar. Ferg did make reference to the word genocide. And when you completely clear out a populated region for whatever purpose, well, yeah, I think you can make the argument. And when 4,000 people are statistically excess deaths in mountaintop removal communities every year, yeah, I think you can make the argument. Me, I think I would have preferred the phrase, and we talked about it. It's a good hour and 15-minute drive from Charleston back to here, and we were making it about, well, after late at night. You saw what time this thing wrapped up, and I told him I would have used the phrase ethnic cleansing, because it's more a matter of sweeping the hillbillies out of the hollers so they can blow up their mountains. But if you want, you can go and watch. And thank you to all of those of you who did. Naturally, Isaac was watching, and he did a screen cap to me of, yeah, me, Bob Kincaid, without socks on. But I don't wear socks before Labor Day unless I can possibly help it. So, you know, this was a surprise. And for some reason or another, me sitting on the... I should have known better than to sit on the front row of the daggum in the audience. But I tell you what, it never mind me, because I was just sitting there. I've talked a lot about my buddy and colleague, Bo Webb, over the years, and especially in the last couple of years as we worked together to bring the AIC campaign to both fruition and success. You get an idea of why he is such a dynamic leader? He sat there surrounded by coal thugs and, well, one frack thug, and simply deconstructed them. Had there been one more person on that panel speaking up for Appalachian human rights and health, well, dang, it would have been unfair. That poor woman, what was her name, Goes? The one in white at the right spot. I don't know. She looked like she was ready to have a conniption. And poor old Bill Rainey down at the other end of the... You know, if I worked in that industry and I heard Bill Rainey referring to me with the possessive my in front, my men, my people, I think I might tend to just get a little bit cranky. But that's the sort of elitism that you get out of that industry. Well, yes, Isaac, Joe Scarborough doesn't wear socks, too. I know that. We both went to the same university. You know, Harvard on the Black Warrior River. You know, the University of Alabama. Most guys down there don't wear socks. We get a nice pair of Docksiders and wear them for 2 years and then, you know, burn them. But the other thing I found a little bit interesting about the town hall, I mean, that thing was almost as tightly produced as a reality show. But the other thing about it was that he kept mentioning, well, gosh, we're all worried about whether or not we may attack Syria as soon as Barack Obama is done with his war on coal. But and we all know that the president, not sure, has indicated that there will not be any boots on the ground, and it will be of limited duration, and now the reporting is that it's going to be, it's going to be about 100 cruise missiles. And I'd mentioned it previously, and I got to thinking even further. And I wanted to find, because when anyone anywhere who is a non-combatant is getting bombed, and we will, tell me how smart the damn missiles are. I don't care. We will manage to kill some people who did not need killing when we start raining the death and destruction down in Syria. Maybe it'll be a baby. Maybe it'll be a mama. Maybe it'll be a granny or a granddad. Maybe it'll be an imam at prayers. Maybe we'll accidentally hit a mosque. That'll go over like a turd in a punch bowl. Maybe. But we will kill somebody we didn't want to necessarily kill. And, it was certainly a regrettable loss of life. And yes, we'll call them collateral damage. But what we are doing is acting as the Lord of all creation, because we will, for whoever it is that doesn't see the next sunrise after we start the bombing, we will end that person's universe. Or, no, better yet, we've discussed this before, we will end the universe for that person. Yeah. Or, more likely, persons. But I got to thinking, so I went and did some research about cruise missiles. Do you know that, at least the photos I found, that when a cruise missile flies, it actually has the manufacturer's name on it, like it's some sort of Oldsmobile going down I-95? Raytheon! I bet when you walk into that Raytheon plant, there's American flags hanging all over, protecting freedom, or some such drivel. See, that's part of the reason why I'm sitting here behind a microphone and not in a plant at, say, Raytheon. Because eventually, if my ability to go on living was contingent upon me getting up and going every morning to a plant that manufactures shit like cruise missiles, and I had to contemplate periodically the fact that I was feeding my family by creating engines of massive, massive, destructive, death-dealing power, I think pretty soon I'd be putting myself out of the game. I can't live like that. It's bad enough inside my own head when I think about all the manifest evil for which I'm responsible just by participating in consumer culture. You get the idea. But I did. I got to thinking. And so it turns out, and my good friend Vernon Haltom, who is the executive director of Coal River Mountain Watch, provided some additional data. Oh, dear God. Texas Betsy has just sent me the Raytheon mission statement. Help me, Jeebus. We're on a mission. For over 90 years, Raytheon has helped enable countless missions by remaining committed to a single one. Customer success. Because, that's what it is when you fly a cruise missile, which is essentially based on the design of the Nazi V-1, by the way. When you fly a cruise missile at something approaching supersonic speeds, or just barely subsonic speeds, at low altitude, and ram it into a mud hut or something like that, that's what you're doing. That's what Raytheon's doing. They're remaining committed to a single mission: customer success. Even when customer success means that a father will pull the pieces of his little toddler daughter out of the rubble of the mud hut. Committed to customer success. Mission: tomorrow's technology today. Today's threats wait for no one. Raytheon Global Patriot stands ready to defeat these threats with proven capabilities today that are advanced enough to meet the challenges of tomorrow, except for the death rays. Good God. They even brag. Did you hear that? Maybe it's a gag. Well, no, Raytheon, I didn't hear that. Maybe that's the point. You can't hear the death when it's coming at you, tiny and low and fast. Jeez. Nice bunch, Raytheon. I did basic math. You know, it's 5.5 million pounds. That's the number of high explosives. That's the amount of high explosives that are used in West Virginia and Kentucky every day. Except for Christmas. Right? The mountaintop removal industry uses 5.5 million pounds of high explosives every day in Appalachia. Well, I found out that your average cruise missile carries a 1,000-pound payload conventional explosive warhead. Cold River Mountain Watch Executive Director Vernon Haltom, who once walked around with some nuclear launch keys dangling around his neck, told me that the warhead explosives are roughly 20% more powerful than the ammonium nitrate and fuel oil explosives that are used on a mountaintop removal site. So we took the 5,500, yeah, because that was the number that came out. 5.5 million divided by 1,000 is 5,500. We took the 5,500 and reduced that by 20%. So, yeah, as we contemplate sending 100 or so cruise missiles at $1.4 million and change into Syria and distributing the body parts of perhaps little children, you know, just like Bashar Assad did, as we contemplate doing that, it's worth noting that, good God, those 100 cruise missiles will not even represent one-tenth of the explosive power of the weapons that are used on Central Appalachia every day, except Christmas. Every day. Day in, day out. The explosive force of 4,400 Tomahawk cruise missiles go off in Appalachia every day. Well, that's a good question, Texas Betsy. How many schools can we build, equip, and staff for the cost of a cruise missile? $1.4 million. Oh, I doubt if you can even build one school for $1.4 million. Although, with value-added technologies, you could probably build two in Syria. So that's where that's where my mind has been. Just thinking about explosives and what they do to people and communities. Because, of course, the mountaintop removal industry uses high explosives every bit as tactically and strategically as do we, as does our military. And just as is the case with sending cruise missiles into Syria, the coal industry doesn't want to poison and kill anybody, per se. It's not their purpose to poison and kill anybody. But people do get poisoned and killed from the use of these explosives in Appalachia, and it's the same thing with the United States military. They don't necessarily want to explode, say, a four-year-old Syrian toddler into 1,000 tiny pieces for her mommy and or daddy if they happen to survive to pick up. They just don't give a good goddamn if they do, because, you know, war's messy. And you're going to have your collateral damage. So, you know, General Brushcut will yell, "Fire!" And some 18-year-old pimply-faced kid, a year, or 19-year-old, a year out of, or maybe it'll be Admiral Dick for Brains, "Fire!" And some 19-year-old pimply-faced kid sitting behind a chair with a screen in front of him, either on a ship or in a plane, who knows, will push a button and it'll be really impressive, and the for-profit media will be there, and well, they won't really be there, but they'll take the video feed footage, and they'll run it on CNN, and they'll run it on MSNBC, and they'll run it on Fox, and they'll run it on CBS and ABC and NBC, and they'll run it, and they'll run it, and they'll show the missile going up out of the boat, the ship, out of the plane, off the ground, God knows where. And, you know, oh, we're teaching those Syrians a lesson, aren't we? And sometime later, a father or a mother, one or the other, or neither, perhaps, because maybe they'll both be blown into many hundreds of tiny pieces as well. Well, somebody in the aftermath will pick up the little pieces of some toddler somewhere. Because, you know, freedom! This makes me sick. I couldn't resist tweeting it earlier in the day when I just happened to turn on Chicken Noodle News long enough to see babbling idiot. Refer in a having had the topic tossed to her by Wolf Blitzer, refer to President Not Sure as a reluctant warrior. I kid you not, a reluctant warrior. Talking about how, oh, President Obama doesn't like war. He's gotten us out of Iraq and trying to get us out of Afghanistan too, and he doesn't like war, but sometimes you have to do this sort of thing. He's a reluctant warrior, and I thought about the reluctance involved with 1 minute being a 16-year-old innocent son of a guy in Yemen. But you also happen to be an American citizen. 1 minute, you're the innocent 16-year-old son of a guy that we don't like who is in Yemen. And the next minute, well, the universe is over. You don't have to wait for any sort of giant kaboom. Well, there was a giant kaboom. I mean, and then the 16-year-old American citizen boy turned into about 1,000 pieces of himself to be picked up by people who do that sort of thing in that part of the world, you know. Put fires out and pick up pieces of American citizen children who have been extrajudicially assassinated by a drone. And I wondered how reluctant that 16-year-old would think President Not Sure had been. Well, son, you're 16 and everything. Well, son, you're 16 and everything, and just let me say, this is going to hurt you more than it hurts me. Fire! No, I got no patience for this bullshit. You either commit to peace and nonviolence, or you say, hey, you know, you want to make an omelet, you're going to break a few eggs, and this particular Syrian omelet, you know, the eggs will be 3-year-olds, maybe. Or maybe I'm overstating the case. Maybe it won't be a 3-year-old. Maybe it'll be a 23-year-old who didn't have any choice, who is marching around, marching up and down the square in his little Iraqi army costume, who would be shot if he wasn't, who, in the greatest horror of the human condition, is truly caught between Scylla and Charybdis, between the devil and the deep blue sea, and so keeps marching up and down the square, or standing his post, or whatever, when the whoosh, boom! No more 23-year-old conscript. And since he had... since he had his little Iraqi, I mean Iraqi, I'm sorry, since he had his little Syrian army costume on, we'll say that he was a legitimate target, because he was a military asset. Boom!
Here it took the Union Jack, and Maggie over lunch one day took a cruiser with all hands, apparently to make him give it back. Thank you. is every morning. Are you having a nice time? Now the final solution can be applied.
What is it about August and starting wars? I mean, aren't we? Jim just wrote in a minute ago. He said, "Israel is on a war footing. Gas masks are being issued as you speak. Mass exodus from Syria by many who have means, or any perhaps who have the means." Things of August 1914. September the 1st, 1939. Oh, how charming! Won't it just be ironically delicious for everybody who isn't being blown into a thousand tiny pieces if we send the cruise missiles into Syria on September the 1st, 2013? Won't that just be... She does work overtime, the goddess of irony. She'll just be sitting up there on her columnar pedestal, cackling away at the delicious irony of it all. Yeah. See, this is what happens when you've got a president who spends his summer holiday reading biographies of Reagan. God, God, God. Russian Foreign Ministry, Isaac, letting me know via Twitter. Russian Foreign Ministry noting that Washington's threats to attack Syria are unacceptable. I guess I just have to get this out of my system this evening because, on or before Labor Day, we will likely have begun raining this death down upon Syria. And, you know, it probably won't even take a day. It'll just be, you know, whatever 100 times, well, it'll be $114 million worth of grim death delivered at 1,000-pound payloads at a time. No regime change. Not that that would make things any better, but just because we have to do something. And when you pick up the phone and you call the boys over at the Pentagon and you say, "Hey, we got to do something. What do you suggest?" They say, "Well, you know, we're the Department of Hammers, and Syria sure looks like a nail to us. So why don't you bomb the snot out of them, Mr. President? But you don't want to do it yet because you want to give the Israelis time to issue the gas masks and as many people to create a refugee nightmare in Syria as humanly possible." And so the community organizer, "All right, that sounds good to me." I once said that starting a war with Iran would be a deal breaker for me with Mr. Obama. I didn't see Syria coming. And I didn't see the Arab Spring coming, and I didn't see Libya coming, and, you know, I think the deal breaker already happened. I don't know if we've got any cruise missile liberals in the Horn family commune. I hope not. And frankly, Joe Biden, bless his heart, has made a hypocrite of himself. While in the Senate in the early parts of the first decade of the 21st century, he said he would support impeachment of George Bush if he went to war without consulting Congress. Now it's okay. Our buddy Senior Bean sent me an excerpt from a Juan Cole post. He said, "Juan Cole has always been good for me, and this sounds about right. My favorites from the post include the following, but are not limited to: one, if chemical weapons have been used in Syria, then preventing its further use in no way suggests that Syrian casualties and suffering will be reduced, given that at least 99% of deaths are not attributable to chemical weapons. It would therefore appear legitimate to question whether preserving the norm on chemical weapons should trump all other considerations on the impact for Syria and the region in driving our policy. Two, given that the backers of the Assad government in Moscow and Tehran have rushed to condemn chemical weapons use, a better strategy might be to pursue a stronger evidentiary base. It will not be easy for Assad to use or again use chemical weapons on a mass scale and in ways that would be ever more detectable under these circumstances. Whatever legal arguments are advanced, an attack on Syria would inevitably fuel the belief around the world that Western powers are willing to act outside the UNS, United Nations Security Council, even when they wish military action, Military action would help reinforce the international norm against the use of chemical weapons, but arguably undermine the norm against the use of force without United Nations Security Council backing. Every time that Western companies bypass or act outside the UN Security Council, we undermine international legality and collective security, which is not in our long-term interest. As General Dempsey quoted in his letter, once we take action, we should be prepared for what comes next. Deeper involvement is harder to avoid. The possible impact on the refugee situation cannot be a secondary consideration. And so on, says Senior Bean. This is why I stick with violent video games ever since we solved Iraq. Yeah. And then there was something yesterday, you know, like I said, played hooky yesterday because we went down to the town hall. And I was listening to the radio, and it wasn't some talk radio program. It was I was listening. It's something the little fifth smallest radio market in America, right wing AM station where I used to work was broadcasting. Apparently, there is a new sort of all newsy format. Not necessarily some screaming person, right wing. They deliver the news. It sounds a little bit like news until you put the filter in and you go, oh, wait, this is right-wingery. And at some point in time, and I just kind of have to, it's a little hard, you don't bend so good when you get old. It's a little harder to pat myself on the back, but I am. Because I had been thinking, gee, I wonder how long it will be before some clever wingnut declares that the chemical weapons being used in Syria are actually Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons that Saddam Hussein sent to Syria to hide because there really were chemical weapons in Iraq, and no, George Bush was not a needle-dicked little moron who had a war fetish because of his Oedipal complex related to his father. So there I am driving down the road, and I'm listening to the radio station, and you've got this woman with a pleasantly newscastery radio voice. And to talk about the Syrian issue, she brings on the communications director of the Texas Republican Party. No, really. Who then begins opining and halfway into it and says, and, of course, we must always remember that these may very well be the same chemical weapons that Saddam Hussein actually did have, but shipped off to Syria so we couldn't find them to make George Bush look bad. I was by myself in the automobile at the time, and I just screamed, son of a... Because when I had originally thought that, I thought, you know, that's just nutty. You'll have to go out to write Blagoslava to find that kind of crazy thinking. But there it was, being broadcast on the commercial airwaves and landing in the little right-wing ears of listeners in and around Beckley, West Virginia. I'll be damned. Yeah, sometimes you just get these little hints from the universe. So we're going to, we're going to get involved in this mess. And you know, I fully expect that there's somebody out there who's willing. You know, if it only takes a day to lob 100 cruise missiles into Syria, then there will be something. Well, see, Bob, it was just one day. But, you know, there will be human beings for whom it will only be 1 second. And the universe, for them, will end. T.S. Eliot wrote April is the cruelest month. He wrote that having witnessed the horrors and carnage of the First World War. But I'm beginning to think that it may be August. Congress goes home, everybody leaves the sweltering heat of the Capitol. K Street lobbyists dangle their toes in the blue waters of the Gulf or the Atlantic coast or the Caribbean. People seek relief from the heat. And in certain circles, some folks who have not yet left go about the bloody business of creating hell on earth. Why is it, in the wake of a chemical weapons attack, the first call, never mind. Just stop. You know, at the Lincoln Memorial the other day, they had a little shindig. A little shindig to commemorate the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. As Sandra noted, the For Jobs and Freedom part having been conveniently left out by everybody, including National Petroleum Radio. And Bill Clinton spoke and told us to quit whining. And Barack Obama spoke and quoted from the Declaration of Independence. And Jimmy Carter spoke. No president ever goes sinless or blameless. But that man is the only man to occupy the presidency in the last... Well, since the first couple of terms of Franklin Roosevelt, who didn't get us into some kind of warfare. And for that, if only that, he should be remembered. And he delivered a real dandy, too, the speechifying. A real dandy. To which apparently not many people were listening. And then later this afternoon, earlier this afternoon, I should say, I heard President Obama, who had invited the presidents of Latvia and Estonia to come and hang out with him at the White House, declare once again what a monster Bashar Assad is because he kills women and children. I could not help remembering another president just a scant 10 years ago declaring that Saddam Hussein was a monster because he killed his own people. Using, of course, weapons that we sold him because... The real motto of America is the business of America is business. It has nothing to do with In God We Trust.
He killed his own people. That's why I'm going to send a few thousand Americans over there to get killed, too. That'll show that, Daddy.
Yeah. So I heard Barack Obama say something about something kind of Bushish about how Bashar Assad kills women and children. And it felt like ashes in my ear. And I was trying to figure out why that would be. And then a couple of things occurred to me, and I realized why. Why it might just have a certain hollow thump to it when I heard an American president complaining about some brute killing women and children. And then it occurred. Then I knew why. This is from Wikipedia. Black Kettle, a chief of a group of around 800, mostly Northern Cheyenne, reported to Fort Lyon in an effort to establish peace. After having done so, he and his band, along with some Arapaho under Chief Niwot, camped out at nearby Sand Creek, less than 40 miles north. The Dog Soldiers, who had been responsible for many of the raids on whites, were not part of this encampment. Assured by the U.S. government's promises of peace, most of the warriors were off hunting buffalo, leaving only around 60 men, women, and children in the village. Most of the men were either too old or too young to hunt. Black Kettle flew an American flag over his lodge, since previously the officers had said this would show he was friendly and prevent attack by U.S. soldiers. Setting out from Fort Lyon, U.S. Army Colonel John Chivington and his 700 troops of the 1st Colorado Cavalry, 3rd Colorado Cavalry, and a company of the 1st Regiment New Mexico Volunteer Cavalry marched to Black Kettle's campsite. On the night of November 28th, soldiers and militia drank heavily and celebrated their anticipated victory. On the morning of November 29th, 1864, Colonel Chivington ordered his troops to attack. Two officers, Captain Silas Soule and Lieutenant Joseph Kramer, commanding the 1st Colorado Cavalry Companies D and K respectively, refused to follow Chivington's order and told their men to hold fire. Other soldiers in Chivington's force, however, immediately attacked the village, disregarding the American flag and a white flag that was run up shortly after the soldiers commenced firing. Chivington's soldiers massacred many of its inhabitants. Mm-hmm. It was at this time, or prior to the firing, that someone looked to Colonel Chivington and said, "What about the women? What about the children? Do we spare the children, Colonel?" And he merely looked at them and said, "Nits make lice." Actually, the whole quote is as follows. "Damn any man who sympathizes with Indians. I have come to kill Indians and believe it is right and honorable to use as any means under God's heaven to kill Indians. Kill and scalp all, big and little. Nits make lice." Mr. John Smith in 1865 testified to the Congress of the United States, "I saw the bodies of those lying there cut all to pieces, worse mutilated than any I ever saw before. The women cut all to pieces, with knives scalped, their brains knocked out, children 2 or 3 months old, all ages lying there, from suckling infants up to warriors. By whom were they mutilated? By the United States troops." Stan Hoig remarked, "Fingers and ears were cut off of the bodies for the jewelry they carried. The body of White Antelope, lying solitarily in the creek bed, was a prime target. Besides scalping him, the soldiers cut off his nose, ears, and testicles, the last for a tobacco pouch. Then Kit Carson said, just to think of that dog Chivington and his dirty hounds up that there Sand Creek. His men shot down squaws and blew the brains out of little innocent children. You call such soldiers Christians, do you? And Indian savages? What do you suppose our Heavenly Father, who made both them and us, thinks of these things? I tell you what, I don't like a hostile redskin any more than you do. And when they're hostile, I've fought them, hard as any man. But I never yet drew a bead on a squaw or papoose, and I despise the man who would. And yes, it's the 30th day of August. And yes, as Texas Betsy notes, it's the anniversary of Katrina. Dear God. I'm just saying we don't really have a lot of moral high ground to stand on. It's not even a moral anthill at this point anymore. And of course, that's just the Sand Creek Massacre. There's also Wounded Knee. You know Wounded Knee. More people don't know about Sand Creek. That's why I shared with you the part about Sand Creek. But you know Wounded Knee, right? Jim, taking the long view, noting, once turned on, one cannot turn it off. Subject line, consequences. Once turned on, one cannot turn it off. Dire outcomes at best. Dominoes began to fall, and events follow beyond control. Please do not do this, Mr. President. Your dreams exceed your powers. Yeah, but Jim, think for a minute. Think what that's like. You're the President of the United States, and you know that you can kill with a word. At some point in time, that's going to be something you're going to do. Yeah, go ahead. Wipe them out. Fritz writing from Arkansas, driving back from Little Rock today. I heard a constant beating of the war drums on NPR's All Things Considered. Liberal NPR had two conservatives discussing Syria, while a cruise missile liberal on NPR seemed to agree whilst wringing hands over Britain's vote in Parliament because, lo and behold, I'll be damned, the British decided that they didn't want to play at this bloody little game, and their Parliament said no. Would that our Congress had the same kind of courage. Dr. John, with what I think is a very, very serious inquiry. Now, I've ever heard Dr. John say this before. He says, this is a really shitty thing to say. We want to kill Syrians because the government is killing its own people, right? We think this will change the regime's bad behavior, right? Okay. Would our behavior in the United States change if someone shot missiles at us? Would we stop legal killing by police and prisons? Would we stop letting immortal corporations poison Americans? Would we stop allowing poor people to die for want of preventive health care? Yeah, in that little inquiry, it just becomes crystal clear. I mean, the focus just goes zzz. I mean, it's a hard edge, tight focus. And you realize in that instant that we're not setting out to accomplish any foreign policy goal with an attack on Syria. We're doing it because we got to do something. And you know what? The late great Bear Bryant on the football field, in his locker room, he had a sign that said, "Make something happen." And that's okay on the football field. Doing something to be doing something just because you have a shitload of wearing out cruise missiles is not foreign policy, and it is not the action of a civilized nation. No, no, no. So I was thinking about... And the goddess of irony must be... Anybody, let's see. He was 39 when he was murdered in 1968. That means he would have been 69 in 1998, 79 in 2008. Dr. King would be in his middle 80s about now. And everyone has speculated in the last week on what would Dr. King think of fill in the blank. Like Sandra said the other night, I'm familiar with more of, you know, I know a little bit more about what Dr. King said than just the speech in August in 1963 in front of the Lincoln Memorial. Is there anybody out there that thinks that Dr. King would be approving of sending 100 or so, $1.4 million each cruise missiles into Syria because we couldn't figure out anything better to do? Because I don't think so. And, you know, after you give the launch order, Mr. President, I don't think you even need to let Dr. King's name leave your mouth ever again. Ever. Because you can stand up there at the Lincoln Memorial and give some high-toned words, but you put the lie to every last one of them. Every last one of them. When you give that order to fire! Yeah, don't fire until you see the pinks of their pacifiers. Maka, writing in. Cavalry. He says, this is why people ask me why I have a problem with white folks. I try not to, because it was years ago and generations have passed. But hell, when you bring up Wounded Knee and Sand Creek, it brings it rushing back. I am Lakota, and Wounded Knee is always on our mind. We are very aware of how the government treats people when they want something and what they're willing to do to get it. I'm glad you brought up Sand Creek. More people should know about it. Sincerely, Maka, Swift Eagle. Yeah. Kevin in Colorado Springs writing, Chivington. Sand Creek not being too far from here, we periodically endure those with not a good grasp of history who would name something or other after the great warrior Chivington, which, of course, is followed by an equally, if not greater, outcry of Native American and non alike to set the record straight and not name anything after him. While his name does start with a Z, no, it starts with a C, Kevin. I'm not completely sure of the spelling, but I wonder if a shiv, yeah, is a crude instrument fashioned to stab someone, often in prison setting, often in the back, and I wonder, did the word shiv come from Chivington? It would be fitting, wouldn't it? Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if we're going to, I'm just asking here. I wonder if we're going to send cruise missiles into Syria based on the content of Syrian character. Charlie Pierce over at his blog at Esquire.com today brought up the fact that, you know, just a little reminder, because these things are beneficial. It was to Syria that we, the people of the United States, who are working on that more perfect union, rendered a man named Mar Arar, a Canadian, where he was kept in a 3-by-6-foot torture cell, you know, basically a coffin, for 367 days. When he tried to sue over the hell that he had been put through by the Syrians, at the insistence of the United States of America and we the people trying to form that more perfect union. The courts of the United States said, no, 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 Mr. Arar. You may have been tortured and whipped and beaten and had your mind shredded for 367 days on a bullshit order of the United States government, and you weren't even a terrorist, and we acknowledge that, but you know what? We got us some national security secrets, and case dismissed. Goodbye. Sometimes we chuckle at what the goddess of irony does, but I remember how Kate has from time to time said, why do you guys laugh? This stuff, she's brutal when she decides to be. And she is. Oh, she is, she is, she is.
I'd never seen a man so broken up and ripped apart.
I've seen horrors. Horrors that you've seen. But you have no right to call me a murderer. You have a right to kill me. You have a right to do that. But you have no right to judge me. It's impossible through words describe what is necessary to those who do not know what horror means. Horror. Horror has a face, and you must make a friend of horror. Horror and moral terror are your friends. If they are not, then they are enemies to be feared. They are truly enemies. I remember when I was with Special Forces. It seems a thousand centuries ago. We went into a camp to inoculate some children. We left the camp after we had inoculated the children for polio. And this old man came running after us, and he was crying. He couldn't say. We went back there, and they had come and hacked off every inoculated arm. There they were in a pile. Pile of little arms. And I remember I cried. I wept like some grandmother. I wanted to tear my teeth out. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I want to remember it. I never want to forget it. I never want to forget. And then I realized, like I was shot. Like I was shot with a diamond bullet right through my forehead. And I thought, my God, the genius of that. The genius. The will to do that. Perfect, genuine, complete, crystalline, pure. And then I realized they were stronger than we, because they could stand it. These were not monsters. These were men, trained cadres. These men who fought with their hearts, who have families, who have children, who are filled with love. But they had the strength. The strength to do that. if I had 10 divisions of those men, then our troubles here would be over very quickly. You have to have men who are moral and at the same time who are able to utilize their primordial instincts to kill without feeling, without passion, without judgment, without judgment. Because it's judgment that defeats us.
Minutes past the hour on this Friday on the front porch. You ever heard that song? I'm sure a number of you have, but a bunch of us, I'll bet, haven't. That is, you remember the big pop hit, Come and Get Your Love by the band Redbone? That's them, too. We were all wounded at Wounded Knee. And, back when it was released, you're going to love this, American for-profit radio refused to play it, and in some cases, the record was taken out and destroyed. You see, this nation cannot bear to be reminded of the horrors that we have perpetrated. Cannot bear it. But horrors we have in abundance. And like I said, it's Friday on the front porch, and we're going to get started here in a second. The Skype group is online over in on the Skype computer. And if you want to be a part of that, just shoot me a note, and I'll shoot it on to Duncan if you've never done it before, and you can jump right in. Got a couple of blinking lines on the phones. We're going there, too. Before that, the horror speech, the horror monologue from Apocalypse Now, Colonel Kurtz, as portrayed by Marlon Brando. And just a little, you know, since I did mention the commemoration of the March on Washington for jobs and freedom, this, I think, bears mentioning. Because I'm betting it was not mentioned at the commemoration. Maybe it was, maybe I just missed it. But of course, starting with Dr. King, there were a lot of people who were not present at the 50th anniversary who had been there originally. In fact, I heard it said that the only person who spoke this past week who had spoken at the original March on Washington for jobs and freedom was John Lewis. But the man, and this is just one of those little moments of trivia, the man who delivered in Apocalypse Now that monologue on horror was Marlon Brando. He was there in 1963 at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. And like I said, I imagine he probably wasn't mentioned. But the fact of the matter is, Marlon Brando had been actively engaged in the civil rights struggle. He was there in Washington for the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom with Harry Belafonte, James Garner, Charlton Heston, who would go on to embarrass himself by advocating that everybody needs a gun, Burt Lancaster, and Sidney Poitier. He and Paul Newman had participated in the Freedom Ride. After the assassination of Dr. King in 1968, he quit a movie role in a film called The Arrangement so that he could devote himself to the civil rights movement. He told Joey Bishop, "I felt I'd better go find out what it is to be black in this country, what this rage is all about." By the early 1960s, Marlon Brando had become a very, very wealthy man, and he gave thousands upon thousands of dollars to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and even established a scholarship fund for the children of Medgar Evers. He gave money to the Black Panthers. He was a friend of Bobby Seale. And yet, most people only know him as Don Vito Corleone. The man walked on picket lines over housing discrimination. He testified before the California State Assembly in support of fair housing laws. Anybody who followed it from beginning to end, do you happen to know? Was it was he even mentioned? Because it strikes me that he walked the walk and he talked the talk. And by the way, before I go any further, we will close out, because Scott in Sweden will want to know this. We will close out the month of August having met our goal. It happened last night. It happened last night and today. So, thank you to VJ, Andy, thank you to Randy, thank you to Sandra, Henry, and everybody else who kept us afloat this August and made September a little more likely. In terms of scheduling, just to let you know real quick, I'm not going to be gone all of next week. When I go to Wisconsin, I'm just going to be gone on Friday. But there may not be a show on Wednesday because of something that is developing rather quickly, and I will advise once I know more. No show on Monday for Labor Day. Going to try to enjoy a little family time. So this being Friday on the front porch and it being 18 minutes past the hour, I'm going to do several things at one time. I'm going to bring the telephone lines on. Hi, guys. Who have I got?
Well, you got the old guy in Cleveland.
Hey, Bill.
Yeah, that's me.
Hello.
Jim?
I'm here.
Awesome. Okay, so let's bring on the Skype group. Hey, guys.
Hi, Bob.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
Okay, so we've got Sergi, we got Tracy, we got Larry, we got Duncan.
Hola.
Hola. We got Senor Bean, we got Jason.
And Jeffrey in the Netherlands.
And Jeffrey in the Netherlands. Hey, Jeffrey, long time no talk to.
Hi, Bob.
Welcome to Friday on the Front Porch. Who wants to go first?
Maybe Tracy should go first. He just got through with a passenger.
Yeah, I did. I mean, but that means, and no means that I should go first. But hi, y'all. Long time no see, no talk to, and all that good stuff.
Yes, yeah, it's been a while.
I mean, there's been so many things going on in the news cycle. I just, you know, where do I start? Do I start with Scott Walker saying that the reason why there's a problem in Syria is because there's no jobs in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that was beautiful, wasn't it?
Wait, what?
Huh? Run okay, that back.
Well, he's working hard to get that way, isn't he?
I think I'm going to need a recap on that one.
I think I'm going to need a Thorazine dart in the neck on that one.
Okay, that just shorted out my brain. Did he seriously blame that?
No, go ahead. Let her talk. Let her explain it. I want to hear it.
Go, Tracy.
She can't stop laughing.
No, I saw it, and it made my head spin, and my eyes water, and from my head. Trayvon Martin, and it's just a hot mess. I mean, you know, you go from, they get rid of DOMA, and then they gut the, you know, the fourth, section four of the Voting Rights Act, but everything's okay. I'm still trying to figure out what's going on in Syria as is because I'm terrified. I mean, I know that Great Britain declined to become involved, but now I'm hearing France is thinking about putting their toe in, and what is it? I mean, does the gun lobby have not enough money yet?
Well, remember, Tracy, you know, you can kind of explain Syria's or France's participation because Syria used to be theirs.
Yeah,
oh!
At the close of the First World War, after we were done screwing over the people who had largely run the Ottoman Turks out of the Middle East, Syria, by virtue of the Sykes-Picot Treaty, was created as the French Mandate.
Yeah, they got Lebanon, too, I think.
I love how you can just give them a whole country away.
it's like, oh, okay. You know, you can take Syria. We'll take this part, and you can take Syria. What the...
Right. So, you know, having been the former colonial power in the area, I guess France is okay with bombing the snot out of it.
I think it has something to do with some money, too. Some, was it gas? Gas interest in the area?
There's some pipeline stuff, isn't there?
Yep. You know, it's the old story, just add money. Yep.
Is there not pipeline shit going on all around the world?
Yep.
There's something going on in Syria, though, between a pipeline interest between Europe and Iran.
Yep.
Both of them want to run a pipeline through there or something.
Wasn't the big thing in Afghanistan, Unocal pipeline that was supposed to come from...
The Caspian Sea Basin, Duncan?
Yeah, a lot of talk about it, yes, sir.
Kazakhstan or somewhere and run through Afghanistan.
Yes, sir.
So it seems like there's always a pipeline in the works.
Well, it's something full of green somewhere, full of gold somewhere, yeah.
Not to mention a huge lithium vein in Afghanistan.
Well, there is that. Yes. And like I said, there's the in that that story a couple of weeks ago about the Trans-Asian Railway and HP shipping computers from its industrial manufacturing base in central China to Germany. There was this one little sentence way down in there that talked about the massive massive Chinese mining operation in Afghanistan, I think, wasn't it?
Got me there.
You're talking over my pay grade, Bob.
Well, it was just a throwaway sentence in a larger article about a railroad.
It would surprise me. If there's money there, there's somebody with a handout ready to grab it.
Yeah.
That you know those little red flowers that are a big output in Afghanistan. That's somewhere in the back of everything, there's that little illegal racket. And legal for medicines.
Yeah. I'm sure that the flow of heroin into this country has greatly increased since we've been to war in Afghanistan.
Well, I'll go along with that since I have a good friend of mine whose wife has problems with one of her children from a previous marriage. And then it's pretty big in... The county east of where I'm calling from has a big problem with it. I mean, I saw that one in the 60s with a buddy of mine who borrowed my belt to tie his arm off and then offered it to me. And being a cowardly little son of a person, I backed out on that one. Maybe the smartest move I ever made, if I ever made one at all.
Of course, you always got to remember the drug trade is just a side effect of what capitalism wants to do in the country.
Well, wasn't the Queen of England and the Opium Wars and such in China once upon a time?
The British were indeed involved with that, and that was a major source of revenue for lots of people in the British Empire at that time.
Thank you.
I think one thing we have to ask is, when we go in the country, what happens in the case of Afghanistan, and
Will, your internet connection is beating you to death.
Was to control the drug trade, but often in a brutal fashion. It's very hard that I'm going to bow out and wish everyone a great weekend. And remember, the horn can still use your help.
Come on back. You just try to get reconnected, you know?
All right, I'll try. Let me try again.
Yeah, cheap heroin's becoming as big a problem as meth in this area, which is saying a lot.
I saw coke slide in when I was in the music business in the 70s, and Man, that stuff came out of nowhere, and I wouldn't touch that either. I just, I looked at the great musicians who were killed by smack, and I said, hell, they're a thousand times better than you are on it, goddamn. So, hey, Shorty, I'd leave that shit alone, in my case. Yeah, I just was afraid of it.
Well, look at Billie Holiday.
Yes, Holiday, Charlie Parker.
So many.
And you can keep going, you know.
And, you know.
So many guys and women. And it was a... There was just, I mean, the movie, The Man with the Golden Arm, Frank Sinatra. There's some classic stuff that I
talked. I remember that one.
Yeah, well, I talked to people, Bob, about that stuff. Well, Alf was in black and white, maybe. I don't even watch it, you know. I guess I'm too old, you know. Color was a novel thing when I started watching movies, you know. Not really, but it seemed to be, you know.
Well, you know, going back to the opium trade in China and the opium war.
Yeah.
The Chinese Empire... or what was left of it, they had attempted to create withdrawal programs for people who had become addicted to opium. And, of course, that was not exactly in concert with the British and their interest in the manufacture, sale, and importation of opium.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who hear about the opium war have mistakenly thought that it was the exact opposite. That the British
were going to stop it, yeah. You're right.
The British were going in there trying to eliminate the opium trade, and that's the exact opposite. They were doing everything they could to promote it.
Yeah, they were living off it. Well, there's some talk about some parts of the U.S. power structure having some involvement in the importation of things too, and I don't want to sound like a paranoid idiot, but nothing surprises me. The older I get, the less I'm surprised by things.
Well, I say that to Bob many times in emails. Nothing surprises me anymore, you know.
Yeah, but I tell you what, really, when you consider this impending attack on Syria in light of the fact that President Obama stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Talking about a man whose principal operating philosophy was nonviolence. The hypocrisy is almost entirely too much to bear, is it not?
Well, I mean, look at the beginning of World War One, when the Tsar of Russia said that he didn't want to go to war either, but...
You mean the three cousins, the King of England, the Tsar of Russia, and the Kaiser, yes.
Yes, exactly, and of course, he and Willy of Berlin, Kaiser Wilhelm, they exchanged these telegrams and stuff like that called the Willy Nicholas telegrams, and this was right at the eve of the mobilization. And the requests were for the Tsar not to mobilize his troops because the Kaiser would have to mobilize his.
Yep, that was the way it went. You do it and I'll do it.
Oh, and by the way, we just got a note in from Cassie, who is busy up at college, our Ivy Leaguer. And Cassie says, Dear Horn Chatting Group, my mom is a heroin addict, and it has caused her to throw away a career and a family and spend decades in prison. It's had a huge effect on my life and my brother's, and I don't think people who start drugs for the first time have any idea what it will do to them or their families. Cassie closes saying simply, don't try heroin, or meth, or coke. Really. Love, Cassie.
So I can't tell you how many stupid things I have done in my life, but man, that stuff wasn't one of them. Although, I'm a second-generation pot smoker, because my old man got busted in the mid-40s with a pound of the stuff. But I think I've told you the story too many times, Bob, but my uncle worked for the... The fellas in an area close to where the Cleveland Clinic is and ran it. And my uncle worked for them, and this guy made the deal where the judge was paid off in 46, long before I knew about it. I was only 3 years old. What the hell did I know? But I learned about it in later life.
Well, you know, strangely enough, even the mafia, parts of the mafia did not want to get involved in that because of the terrific consequences of it, and they wanted to, you know, I'm not trying to quote anything from the Godfather.
No, you're right. I knew a kid whose face looked like somebody ran it through a fan, who was a neighborhood resident who got caught selling it to kids in the neighborhood up there. in the ethnic area, and he was told on no uncertain terms. Thank God nobody talked to me that loud in my life.
Well, I mean, you know, they realized exactly the effects that it would have, and you know, it would and it would endanger their other operations and things of that nature. And I think that's basically what Francis Ford Coppola was trying to convey, and when he portrayed that big sit down at the Don Corleone and Barzini and all the other critters around there who, you know, saying, look, you don't want to get involved in it because it's too nasty, it's too damaging, and everything.
To Syria, this guy's father was no damn good either. These are, when you start seeing these family guys, one after another, you know, it's like North Korea. The kid running it now, his grandfather was the running Korea when they got all those nice T-34s. Uncle Joe's down and rolled into South Korea.
Well, I think there's an overarching argument being made here, all the way from the First World War forward, that hereditary monarchies or hereditary tyrannies or hereditary dictatorships or whatever we care to call them ain't a good idea.
Well, it's like when you have you have a Prescott and two Georges.
Well, there's that.
I mean,
it happens
also,
a lot.
As Thomas Paine said, and I'm paraphrasing, too often the monarchy falls into the hands of fools. And this is what we have seen too often, time and time again, in dictatorships of many sorts, namely that you have a brutal father, a son who may come in possibly with the intent of being a reformer, but soon turns out to be as brutal as his father. And in the case of Syria, the old man was very brutal. There's a town named Hama where there are 10,000 people who died under the older Assad, and even mentioning that will get you arrested in Syria. So it's much a continuation of what has been, and I'm afraid there may be no good options in Syria because in a civil war there's usually very few good options for anyone.
I think Dr. John's observation comes back here too. If we think that we're going to change behavior by cruise missiling Syria, then that theory should hold water under other circumstances, should it not?
Yep, and it has.
Well, the trouble is, if in fact he does launch these weapons, he does not have a Congress that is there to formally allow that declaration. And back in 2007, one of the shibboleths of Barack Obama was not to do such a thing. And what I say to you gentlemen is simply this, and I'll let you continue your confab. I would say to Barack Obama what someone should have said to Nicholas II before World War I. Please, sir, get up from the table, go home, and see your family. Don't do this. I will never forget that movie, Nicholas and Alexander, when Laurence Olivier was playing the part of Count Vitti. Remember that, Bob?
Yep.
When he was saying, you know, the world will go mad and be filled with fanatics and idiots, and there will be no sense of restraint, no sense of dignity, no sense of anything that, you know, was former war, or I mean the former existence before. And of course, having listened to the wrong people, the Tsar launched something he could not. Once he launched it, he could not retrieve it. And that's what I meant in my email to happen here with Mr. Obama and the other parts of the world there. I mean, you've got Israel on a war footing now, and you've got all other nations that are just absolutely boiling over. And I don't know how in the world they could send surgical cruise missiles in to alleviate the situation or to ameliorate it. Because, I mean, I don't know, what if these cruise missiles strike stocks of already stored chemical weapons? I mean, that could unleash just an absolute plague.
Exactly. And a great problem is we do not seem to have a long-term plan other than firing missiles and hoping for the best. What is really needed is more of a diplomatic effort, but the Arab League is divided. The UN is divided, and I don't know if there is anything we can do that's going to make a difference in the lives of innocent civilians. And that's the problem.
Well,
basically, people just need to stop and realize that killing each other is not the answer to anything.
Well, exactly. All it does is breed more killing.
It's taken me years and years to come to that, because I started out as a kind of big-time military proponent guy. Even wanted to join the military. I look back today and realize that if I had gotten into the Air Force and done what I wanted to do, and I couldn't because I was colorblind, thank God, I couldn't fly jets, but I would have already bombed 8 countries.
Yeah, the same thing happened.
And I'm only 36 years old.
I was colorblind, and I thought nothing could be greater than the pilot Thunderbird or one of the other planes at that time. But nonetheless, went on to other duties. But I can understand, you know, the attraction in a young man, and that's what they try to engender. But I mean, when you really are in the cockpit of that weapon, and it is a or Phantom or whatever you want to call it, a Phantom F4C, that's really, if you just look at one even now that they're basically out of production, boy, is that not an engine of destruction. It is just awe-inspiring just to look at one. And it's not, you know, I guess it's easier to push a button than,
well, I didn't realize until I went wandering around last night trying to find out the cruise missile equivalent of what gets used on the United on Appalachia.
Oh yeah.
I didn't realize that the cruise missile is basically a beefed up, more technically advanced V1.
Oh, it's much more than that.
Well, I mean, that's the origin of the cruise missile, and it's not that far removed.
Well, V1s could go up and they could come down, and they had no discrimination as far as where they would land. They would just aim them. It was just like a point-and-shoot type thing with no intelligence. But a cruise missile is much more sophisticated, and it can carry other types of armaments than just conventional ones. But, I mean, it's extremely capable in doing the job it was designed to do. And,
hey Jim, weren't the Germans shooting that off of part of Holland that nobody could get at?
They started at Peenemünde, and then of course there was a British raid in Peenemünde, and then they had to sort of transfer a lot of their stuff to other more hidden parts of Germany in the Harz Mountains. And there was one place called Dora, which was a notorious concentration camp inside of a mountain. And I don't know how many thousands of people died manufacturing those you had the buzz bomb, the V1, then the V2, the rocket itself. But, I mean, it was, like I say, the forefather of the cruise missile.
Yeah.
Except the cruise missile, like I said before, is extremely capable, and it can literally put a warhead right through the window of wherever it's programmed to go. I mean, they're pretty accurate things compared to the old V1.
Yeah, as long as it's not relying on Apple Maps.
Can I say something real quick?
Go ahead, Duncan.
I know about that. I think the people who are in control of those particular types of devices have extremely sophisticated guidance control, and when they can paint their target with a laser, and that's how they basically do that in certain respects, then they can pretty much follow that laser beam right on in with a pinpoint accuracy. But I just can't see any point in in doing this, because it's just going to create more havoc, more destruction. It's going to create a lot of bad feeling. It's already there. And then, of course, we have, what is it, next week, the G20 summit in St. Petersburg?
Yep.
Now, how in the hell is that going to work with President Obama and President Putin?
Yeah, it's just going to be a room full of people looking really sheepish.
Well, I think they're going to be looking more sheepish. They're going to be really pissed off at each other because, I mean, there are just certain ties that the Russian Republic has with some of these nations, and it's not going to do a whole lot of good. As a matter of fact, if Obama does this, I don't see why he'd point where he could go or whatever good it'll do. I mean, except for just sitting there grinning and, you know, looking at Putin across the table like two badgers. I don't know, but I hope I just say this. I will let you go.
Wait. Duncan, you were going to say something.
Well, I was just going to relate to one of my life experiences, having worked on the SR-71 when I was at the Andrews Air Force Base on a static display. We were getting ready to fly the plane back home, and it flew by computer. And I was watching the guy in the RSO cockpit. He was programming the terrestrial navigation aid eyeball that's behind the cockpit. And at first I said, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm telling the plane where it's at." And the same thing applies to a cruise missile. The first thing you got to tell the cruise missile is where it's at, because it work, most of them now work on a GPS, so they got to know where they're at, and then you tell them where you want them to go.
Wow. So you were at Andrews?
Just on a static display. It was during 1972.
Okay, well,
during the 25th anniversary of the Air Force.
Right.
There was a big, they had a big air show there.
Yeah, they always
but,
do.
But I didn't get to stay at Andrews.
Yeah,
they flew
I was
us
there for a long time.
They flew all the maintenance people to McCoy Air Force Base in Florida, and we had to sit there for 3 days until the plane was ready to leave and fly back home, and then we flew in and did our thing.
Oh, I see.
Man, that was long before I would have even imagined they were doing it. Shows you where I'm at. 72, I was having too much fun, playing too much music, and, you know, didn't think much about
it. And all the
it.
Things that go with it, right, Bill?
Yeah, and I didn't think much about it anymore, yeah. Because I remember one Christmas one year when I was maybe 9 years old, one relative handed me a book on rockets and, you know, weaponry of that kind, and my God, it wasn't much past the was it Congreve rockets that they used on
the British
to show up in the Star Spangled Banner, you know?
Well, yeah, those Congreve rockets were fairly accurate, and then yep. Sometimes they weren't, and they were, I think, used at the Battle of New Orleans and things like that. But the British,
yeah, I think they showed up by the rockets' red glare of our national,
yeah, over Fort McHenry,
yeah,
right. Right. Rocketry has always been with us as the Chinese. They developed all types of weapons and things using propulsion systems. Like,
yeah. The rocket goes up. Who cares where it comes down? It's not my concern, says Werner
exactly
von Braun.
Braun, yes.
Well,
God, we're a couple of sick ones.
Well, I don't know. You can't call him that. So he's the father of our modern space program, and he was... he had sense enough to leave where he was so he could be captured by the Americans and under...
Yeah, because Huntsville, Alabama is a hell of a lot more pleasant than Minsk.
Oh, man, yeah. Absolutely. And, of course, they had what they call Operation Paperclip, in which they took a number of very talented scientists who had Nazi backgrounds, and, of course, we took them over here and began to use their prodigy just as the Soviets did when they captured one within the Soviet zone of occupation.
And it could be argued, unless I get a note in, say, from one of our buddies who happens to be a real, live, honest-to-goodness, no-kidding rocket scientist, it could well be that we would have already been on the way to Mars had the man who Harry Truman referred to as Richard Pinhead Nixon not decided that he was smarter than everybody else, and it was Nixon who put the kibosh on because von Braun's plan that took us to the moon was ultimately geared toward taking us to Mars.
Well, he was always interested in that. Even when he came into the German rocket service, I think his boss was Colonel Walter Dornberger. Von Braun had made a statement at some type of dinner in which he had too much to drink. And instead of focusing the German war effort toward defeating the British, that, you know, it's not that I want to do. I want to go to the moon. And, of course, shortly thereafter, von Braun was arrested and taken into prison and locked up. And it was Dornberger who got him out. And then, of course, after they began to show films to Hitler at his Eastern headquarters as to what these weapons could do, that's when, I guess, von Braun became a little more preeminent in the German rocket program. But he got himself in trouble by saying that he wanted to go out in outer space into the moon, as opposed to using these things.
And speaking, Jim, of Nazis on the moon, anyone who has not seen, and I think it's a Finnish film, Iron Sky, really needs to. It is campy and goofy and funny, but by the same token, it's got some reasonably telling little observations in it. If you can imagine a secret Nazi base on the moon in the 21st century that gets discovered during the presidency of Sarah Palin.
Oh my Lord.
This is better than Santa Claus Saves Christmas from the Martians, Jim.
Or Amazon Women on the Moon.
Yeah. No, this is one for the ages. It really is.
Iron Sky. Where did you find this?
Somebody mentioned it on the program one night, and I wound up watching it on Netflix, I think.
Iron Sky. And Sarah Palin was the president.
Yeah.
I'm not going to ask you what her responses were to that. I mean, I'm sure they were interesting.
The woman playing Sarah Palin is brilliant, and of course, it all revolves around a publicity plan by the Palin administration to send a Negro to the moon. Yes, we can.
What? Wait, hold up.
Oh, Lord.
You got Tracy's attention.
You say send a Negro to the moon?
Yes, we can.
Oh.
You haven't seen it, Tracy?
No, but I'm going to, because I'm working my butt off tonight so I can have the weekend with my girl. So, wow.
Yeah, Sarah Palin sends a brother to the moon as part of her re-election effort.
What show is this? Trailer?
Where he discovers the secret Nazi base.
Oh, my God.
What's the base called?
You're in San Francisco, aren't you?
Me? No, I'm in L.A.
Oh, you're in L.A. Okay, I knew you were in California. I couldn't. I had to, you know, I thought it was San Francisco. I don't know what movie you think of it. Because I had so many friends in, you know, in the Bay Area. That's you know, a lot of guys went to L.A. too in the 60s.
Holy mother of God. They sent a Negro to the moon.
Well, I've made Tracy's night.
Bob, yeah. Bios has it. I just put the link for the movie in there.
Oh, okay.
Oh, Jesus.
In the Skype chat.
Yeah, so copy the link. Yeah, what'd you say, Jim?
I was just kind of gobsmacked at the idea of Sarah Palin and what her reaction would be. I mean, that crazy-ass woman. Oh, Lord have mercy. I mean, I can say no more.
I know what everybody's going to be doing this weekend now.
I'm just flummoxed. I'll have to take a look at Iron Sky and see what's going on with it. Gosh.
Yeah, hey, Duncan, could you just real quick, please, if you don't mind, shoot me that link so that I can send it to Jim via email?
Sure.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Thank you, Duncan.
But,
oh,
you know,
God, I'm still.
but let's if you don't care, I want to throw something else out there for consideration of the group. This being Friday on the front porch, and we can kind of wander where we will over the information and horror landscape. I have bitten my tongue to keep from noting that as we see this conflagration developing, or this potential conflagration developing in the Middle East, that we should probably bear in mind that there are people in this country who are saying, let's do it, because, you know, prophecy. But
biblical prophecy.
Yeah. But no, there was another story that hit today that I just, you know, oh no, not again. The book banners are back. It has become almost axiomatic inside the right wing that that the Common Core standards are a Kenyan Muslim socialist plot to warp the minds of our freedom loving children. And consequently, it is spoken of in the same breath as Agenda 21, which, of course, we all know is going to ruin golf for all Americans.
Oh, these people are just a devilish, they're very, very devilish with language, aren't they?
Oh, they are. And so on the Common Core reading list is a book by the last winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature from the United States. That author is, of course, Toni Morrison.
Yeah.
The book is called The Bluest Eye. And I actually read it many, many years ago.
Why?
And it really is. It's literature.
Did you have to read it?
No, I wanted to.
Oh, okay.
I do crazy shit like that, Tracy. I just, you know, read books.
Yeah, well, Toni Morrison and Alice Walker, along with Gloria Naylor and a number of authors, are well thought of, or really well thought of in English departments and in literary circles now.
Well, I have a very dear friend who is a Toni Morrison expert, scholar type. And I'm sure that were I to ring her up down in her digs in Louisianistan, as erudite as she is, there would tell her story, as erudite as she is, she would quickly begin using some of those more colorful words that don't appear in her scholarly papers. Because the state of Alabama, Stan.
Oh, Jesus.
You said it.
Has moved to ban Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye from the 11th grade reading list of Common Core standards.
And why?
Let's see. Here's the quote. The individual being quoted is a person by the name of, Alabama Stan State Senator Bill Holtzclaw.
Oh, God.
Isn't that a machine you put money in, you get a quarter in, you drop something out? Holtzclaw?
Well, except for the fact that it never drops anything out, Bill, yeah.
Exactly! Yeah. I was just going to go there, but I'd give it to somebody else, you know.
So the book is about a little black girl who wants blue eyes. And, you know, there are inquiries into the nature of perception and self-perception and racism and self-image, and it's a magnificent book. So enter Alabama Stan State Senator Bill Holtzclaw, and he wants it banned in Alabama Stan schools. But go ahead, Larry.
One would only wonder what people in those neck of the woods would think of Henry Louis Gates or Bell Hooks.
Oh, well, Bill Hicks is... Bill Hicks. Did you say Hooks or Hicks?
No, Bill.
Bell Hooks.
Bill.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
I want to add a little comment to that right there. Both my little mixed race boys have blue eyes.
Wow.
Well, speaking from a girl who grew up in the 70s, when black was supposedly beautiful, and I had short, nappy hair, and definitely not blue eyes. At one point when I was a kid, all day, because I didn't see anybody on TV who looked like me. So I mean, the only thing I wanted at some point was to be a blonde-haired, blue-eyed white girl, which, of course, now I could care less.
Yeah, with a, with a 17-inch waist and, you know, Barbie.
Right. I wanted to be Barbie. And because there was nobody on TV, only person on TV that looked like me was Butterfly the Queen, McQueen, and Hedy McDaniels. And it's like, you know, and I tribute, you know, I pay homage to those women because they, you know, they opened doors for other black actresses and actors that, you know, they paved the way. But again, what? And so when you, you know, and I can see why people in, is this in Alabama, Stan?
Yes.
That they want to ban the book because it throws, you know, race relations right in your face. Because it's saying, you know what, I don't, you know, when they're, everybody's saying everything's A-okay and, you know, the world is a much better, happier place because, you know, aren't you guys happy we have a black president? You know, get over it.
Who can bomb brown people with real aplomb?
You know, and exactly.
I mean, you know, and you know, I got to go back to this, Tracy, because you just kind of opened that door. We were talking a little bit ago about Putin and Obama sort of eyeballing each other across the table at the G20 summit in St. Petersburg. And I just got this, you know, because Putin completely rickrolled George Bush and had him walking out babbling about looking into his soul and what a decent man he was. Remember? Well, I think when Putin looks across the table at Barack Obama, he's going to be looking at something entirely different because if I was Vladimir Putin, old KGB spook that he is,
yes,
I'd be looking at Barack Obama thinking, I'm going to watch my step around this guy. This is a cool, cold-blooded killer. Because this man can stand at the Lincoln Memorial and memorialize a man who adopted the policy of nonviolence on one day and order the slaughter of brown people in Syria the next. I ain't crossing him.
No.
Well, that's a pretty interesting point of view. I want to inject one here. Has anybody actually thought about or have any insight as to what Putin's, why is he in the position? What does he really want to happen in Syria?
Why don't you keep selling him stuff?
Yeah.
I mean, what is, he's pretty much quiet about it. I have not heard much from them other than they're opposed to any action.
Well, this is, Jason,
he's a capitalist too.
Sure. But he's also a Russian, and Jim can certainly speak to that. But the thing is, you know, they've got their client states. The Cold War may never have actually ended, because this is certainly Cold War conduct. They've got warm relations with Iran, and they've got warm relations with Syria. They want to keep them that way. They want to maintain that is their access to the Middle East, among other things, to oil.
Okay, but what I don't get is you don't hear him out loud saying anything. I mean, there's no reports of him going on Russian national television saying that the U.S. is making a huge mistake. They shouldn't do this or that or whatever.
Oh, no. Just a little bit ago, I had that tweet from Isaac, where he pointed out, let's see here. RT, Russian television, reporting Washington's threats to attack Syria unacceptable, according to the Russian Foreign Ministry. I mean, they have not been silent, Jason.
I just guess it just never leaks into any of our frickin' media.
They're saying, you know, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. And obviously, as between the two arguments presented in that the UK Parliament had access to, Putin's argument, because you know he had a little bit of a tete-a-tete with David Cameron, Putin's argument won the day because the British Parliament just said no, hell no.
Well, if you put it to the American people, I mean, you know, if we had representatives like the British Parliament and you put it to the American people, what the hell do you think America would say? Hell no.
Yeah, because this pending slaughter of brown people has the support of 27% of the American people.
Excuse me, guys, I'm about to order lunch. Don't get mad, Bob, about what you're about to hear. It's going to hurt your feelings.
Oh.
Well, just mute yourself.
Food porn.
I don't know how.
No, she wants to hurt me. She wants to hurt me.
Yeah, keep talking about that good food that I can't get out and get anymore. Yeah.
But anyway, back to Toni Morrison. Sorry for the digression there. Back to Toni Morrison. It turns out that Alabama State Senator Bill Holtzclaw only said what he said after he was criticized by the larger GOP in Alabama stand for not voting to suppress the Common Core, which is, of course, how that Muslim Kenyan socialist with a deep-seated hatred of white people who doesn't like colonialism is going to rot the minds of our precious American children.
Yes, I get a king burger with mustard, onions, cheese.
Mustard, onions, and cheese?
Pickles,
which
relish, and an egg.
Yeah, see, I'll pass on the relish and the egg.
And a vanilla shake, please.
Okay, you say mustard, pickles, onion, relish, cheese, and what else?
Egg.
Egg, okay. And what else?
And a vanilla shake.
Vanilla shake? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else?
That would
I've
be it.
I've never heard of an egg on a hamburger.
Oh, yeah, that's a big deal.
Me either.
Yeah, I've never heard
egg of on a hamburger sounds nasty.
Yeah, see, I'm not an egg guy.
I love eggs.
I like deviled eggs. I like omelets and scrambled eggs, but, you know, like fried egg. Ooh, no.
Oh.
So anyway, go ahead, Duncan.
Sir, if you run your hamburger past Tracy.
Oh, are you talking about my donut burger?
Yeah.
All right, well, what I do
say a donut
is,
burger?
I said a donut burger. I get a conventional glazed donut, although it can also work with those chocolate glazed hybrids. I slice it in half, like lengthwise, like to, you know, basically make two buns. I put a beef patty in the middle, a slice of cheese on either side, and plenty of mayonnaise on either side.
God, how much info do you need?
What did you say, Jim?
How much insulin do you need? I'm sorry.
No. You got to understand, Sergi's so skinny, he has to run around in the shower to get wet.
Well, that's an old joke about China.
Oh, no.
I
used to be skinny. I've started to gain.
And we're surprised. Why? Donut burger, please?
Well, you know what? The L.A. County Fair started today, and as a matter of fact, they do have a Krispy Kreme cheeseburger at.
Well, see, I see, that's probably because of NSA spying, because somebody's seen Sergi talking about his donut burger, and it was quietly passed along to the Krispy Kreme people. God damn, these guys are insidious.
I mean, how are you going to come? I mean, today was opening day, and it's like. I mean, you got, deep-fried pickle wrap with bacon?
Honey, that's not a sandwich. That's a weapon.
Toaster to Jim.
I mean, I had to get out my fan.
Oh, my God.
Have you wandered over to the fainting couch, Jim?
I'm on there with that Pity Pat fan.
The Pity Pat fan, oh, Jesus.
Uh-huh. Signed by Laura Hope Cruz.
Oh, goodness me. Well, can I take us back to Alabama Stan for a minute?
Yeah, let's go back to Alabama Stan.
Because this is just too rich. So after the GOP criticized Alabama Stan Senator Bill Holtzclaw for not being ideologically pure enough to oppose the Common Core standards before our children's minds can be eaten alive by Kenyan Muslim socialism. Well, he took a look at the reading list and found him a book he didn't like. And that was Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, which we discussed a few minutes ago. Speaking to Alabama Stan Media Group, Senate and Bill Holtz call said, the book is just completely objectionable from language to the content. I imagine he doesn't even like the cover art. And another right-winger said that, warning, graphic Common Core approved child pornography.
You know, I'll bet that dude didn't even read that book, and he's talking about it off the top of his head.
Oh, hell no. He can't read it. He can't read it, Larry. If he read it, he might turn into a Kenyan Muslim socialist.
And they probably did. He would have done the same thing with Catcher in the Rye.
I don't think Catcher's on the list.
Oh, my God.
But he wants it taken off the high school reading list. He supports removing the book from every school library in Alabama, Stan.
Oh, my Lord.
I have told parents, if you find something objectionable, I look at it and I listen to you and I lead the charge. Now, this is a man who comes from a place called Madison, Alabama, which is just outside Huntsville, which is why I mentioned it in reference to Dr. Von Braun a little bit ago, because Huntsville is home to the Redstone Arsenal and was home to Dr. Von Braun and is home to massive high technology industry down there. But they sent a book banner to the House, or to the State Senate of Alabama, Stan.
What kind of a mystical trip is this dude on?
You're in Alabama.
I'm sorry, Jim?
I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry. But, I mean, Huntsville is just a federal city. I mean, it's not like any other city in Alabama.
No, there wouldn't be a Huntsville if it wasn't for the federal government. You know, that job-killing, over-regulating federal government.
Right. I mean, you know, it's just a... I've been there, and, I mean, you know, the Redstone Arsenal and everything. I mean, it's when you leave the confines or the environs of that city, it's like you're going into another world.
Without a doubt. We started going to Huntsville. Huntsville was 72 miles east of where I grew up. And we would go there because, I mean, it was booming. They had a huge mall, you know, even back in the mid-60s.
Right.
And they had a little German restaurant where my father could get one, because Madison County, since it had a bunch of Germans in it, was not dry like Lauderdale County was.
Yeah, good beer, at least.
Yeah, so there was a little German restaurant where my father could sit down and drink a really, really good mug of beer in a frozen mug, and little bitty me would get a bowl of warm, sweet and sour red cabbage, you know, which I fell in love with at an early age. It was just special, very special. But now they're sending Bill Holtzclaw to protect our children's minds from Common Core and Agenda 21, too, while we're at it. He said, any reading list in the state of Alabama, there's a slippery slope, and there are folks that will find objectionable material in widely accepted classic American literature. My goal with respect to this book is more the lines of if it is required reading. We can't be requiring little Alabama children to read books that might expand their little old Alabama stand minds.
I wonder where that book will end up.
Well, I'm sure it'll be burned by several churches.
Well, I was just thinking about when they burn books in Germany, when they burn books, they'll soon thereafter, as I think Heine once said, where they burn books, they'll burn people too.
Yep.
Jim,
hey, Bob.
Yeah, Duncan.
My pet peeves in this world is books. I went through an audio copy of Grapes of Wrath. I hadn't seen it since I was a child, you know, teenager. I don't think that would... I asked some of these kids that I know, did you ever read it? No. It's a list. The Jungle, another book that exposed capitalism when the Chinese buy the Daisy Fuel Company. Yeah. Being German, man, pork is like a national dish for me, but I gotta leave it alone, you know. With nowadays, I don't cook much of anything anymore, but, like, what is with the reading? That's one thing I dislike so much. One argument I have with young kids, you read anything, and they don't.
Hey, Bob.
Yeah.
Betsy put a link in the Skype chat that she wanted you to look at. She had to go off to temple.
Oh, okay.
Synagogue, rather.
Shabbat shalom to Betsy.
Yeah, my first wife's family was Jewish, and they accepted a German Catholic for a son-in-law, and a great family, and I learned an awful lot. My father-in-law used to sit and argue about, not argue, but debate why Israel was always being overrun by something. And of course, he brought up the religious angle, and I said, no, look where they were located. If I'm going from North Africa to the Middle East or vice versa or anywhere around the Mediterranean, if you're small and you're sitting there, somebody's licking their chops somewhere, you know. I don't think things have changed that much, have they?
The more things change, the more they stay the same, right, Bill?
Yeah, that was one of my old man's pet sayings. Yeah, it's, you know, so I don't know. You guys with young kids, do they read much at all? Anybody with young kids?
Well, you know, my youngest is 16 now, but we got little bitty grandchildren.
Give them books.
I got young nieces that are, it's hurting my heart thinking about what kind of world they're growing up in.
But you're right, Bill. Buy them books. Our grandchildren have books in their home, and it's a big damn deal.
Well, I was about 5 years old, and I was waiting for my grandmother, who had a lifetime pass from New York Central because my grandfather worked there. And they were coming back. Her and my cousin and my sister were coming back from Niagara, and I'm waiting at this railroad station in East Cleveland. And it was a funny railroad station. It was built in the beginning exclusively for Mr. Rockefeller. So they could get off the train and go right up into an area of Cleveland Heights, Rockefeller land. Yeah, he had a big estate up there once upon a time.
Well,
long before mine.
Oh, by the way, a note in from Robert in Australia. Subject line, the lunch order heard round the world. Robert, the lunch order heard round the world. Is that a first for the horn? I think it may be. And the only way, and the only reason I'm able to sort of survive through it is Tracy didn't stop at the shrimp taco truck.
Yeah. So they're only because they're closed.
No, we don't have any of these here in this big small town of Cleveland. I haven't seen. Well, I used to have them years ago. That would pull up outside a bar at 2 o'clock in the morning, and you had to be leaving the bar to want to eat in some of those places in those days. We used to go to a Chinese place that was open all night, and one of my buddies, we went down there at lunchtime one time and we left. You know, when you're half tank, you can eat anything.
Oh, so in other words, you were so, even in a drunken state, the place looked so terrible that you're like, oh, hell no.
Well, no, we came back the next day. We wouldn't eat there, but see, my thing was chili dogs when I was a kid. That was the, you know, when there was one joint that was selling them for 20 cents a piece. That's how long ago that is.
Jesus Christ, what is...
And while me and my project buddies, we, like Rick Smith, project kids, we'd go down there and say, someday we'll have enough money to eat as many of these as we want. Of course, when you had the money to do that, you wouldn't eat the stuff anymore, you know. It's a shame.
Yeah. But
anyway, what do we do with this lack of knowledge in this country where kids are getting more and more carnival?
Somewhat in that vein.
I saw my generation get real carnival, so, you know.
I took my nephew to a bookstore. He wanted something on dinosaurs, so he finds something, and I'm glad I checked it out first because it was some creationist.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, so, that's what they're talking about, yeah.
Well, remember, they used to sell a Young Earth book at the gift shop at the rim of the Grand Canyon. You know, one of those books that explains The big hole in the ground at which you are now looking is 7,000 years old. No kidding.
7,000?
Yeah, in the National Park Bookshop. Oh, by the way, another Dr. John's been doing a little bit of research. He says, oh, great. Now I know lots about sarin. Been browsing a bit. Centers for Disease Control, Reuters, New York Times, Global Security. Jesus, that stuff is bad. You don't actually have to breathe it to die, you know, in 1 minute. You can get a lethal dose through the skin. Its main inventor was Otto Ambros, one of Hitler's chief chemical experts. He got 8 years at Nuremberg, which reportedly disgusted the prosecutors. Sarin is apparently pretty simple to make. A Reuters reporter bought all the necessary precursors on his credit card with rush shipping. And it's the substance used in the subway attacks in Japan by the cult Aum Shinriko in 1995, which killed 13. Has anyone, and this is just sort of out there for the consideration of the group, Dr. John asks, has anyone looked into all this alleged intelligence pointing to the Assad regime? And what about the UN inspectors who are supposed to be testing the area that was supposedly attacked? Regime officials talking about hiding evidence is one thing, but chemical evidence in the soil doesn't lie, right? And he continues with the subject line, oh shit, and this. Otto Ambros served half his sentence, was brought to the U.S. to advise our chemical weapons researchers, and later worked for Dow Chemical, where he helped. Anybody? Jim?
Sarin.
No. Jim, you want to take a run at this?
I have a good idea. Go right ahead, Bob, and throw me with your acumen here.
Thalidomide.
Oh, Francis Kelsey. Yeah. By the way, the KGB used sarin a lot because all they could do with it, or what they did with it, they could put it in the end of an umbrella.
No, that was ricin, wasn't it?
Ricin, yeah. Or it could be ricin. But I mean, it's just amazing how effective these things are, and they could just put it in the end of an umbrella and pass somebody who is a suspected spy or whatever, and just stick them in the arm. And
yeah, the Hungarians did that to that one dissident in London, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. Yep. Aaron Ricin. Well, I sort of get them all.
It's funny you bring up ricin, because I was at my dad's place in North Carolina the other day. And I pull up in the driveway and I look at this plant he's got growing. And I look at it and it's like, is that a freaking weed? Or what the hell is that? He said, no, that's a castor bean plant. It's a castor bean plant. Isn't that what they make ricin out of? He said, why the hell are you growing one? And he said, well, your cousin sent me some beans and we're just growing it to grow it.
You wasn't too sure what it was? Or what it could do?
No, he absolutely knows what he can do. He's growing it to grow it.
And yet
it's an addition to his garden.
And of course it's also where we get castor oil.
God.
For everybody who's old enough to have been dosed with castor oil at some point in their lives.
Yes, sir.
I'm gonna throw a little curve your way. You know what you can also use those castor beans for, Jason?
Go ahead, let me know.
Long before the discovery of hops, the Egyptians used it to flavor and preserve their beer.
And it didn't kill them?
No, but if you've ever had the beer squirts, you can't even imagine it must be with it flavored with, you know, castor beer berries.
Oh, boy, that's nasty.
Sorry.
Good Lord.
Serge's the drinker.
Well, I'll be thankful to you, Bob, for helping me run down the German beer that was made that they originally brewed in China.
Well, you know, right. See, I'll take good German or English or Scottish or beer. Before I ever go after the Castorberry beer. I mean, you know,
well, you know, no
Pharaoh
wonder,
can keep that shit, right?
No wonder a lot of those Egyptian things that we can see today had strange looks on their faces.
Yeah, that was just a keg party.
Oh God!
I mean, and by the way, speaking of which, for those of you who were watching, that woman last night at the town hall meeting, you know, Joe Manchin's flack. Did she just look like she was gonna turn purple and pop or what?
She was scary looking, Bob.
I mean, I got one tweet from Isaac who said that woman in the white looks like death. And I don't think he meant like she looked like she felt bad. He meant she looked like, you know, hand her a sickle and you know.
And get out of, you better stay out of her way, though. Yeah.
Mr. Death, he says he's come about the reaping.
Did Bo get a creepy feeling sitting next to her?
Well, you know, Bo was creep. It was just all, it was, you know, it's when the level of creepiness is that high, it's hard to tell which way it's coming from.
I mean, that guy, the fracking oil guy, when he started talking about renewable energy being 10 years down the road or decades or something like that, I want to smack him on the side of the head.
Well, yeah, and did you notice he had a real hard time saying he wouldn't like to have him some corporate welfare for fracking?
Yeah, a friend of mine sold land.
Hey,
sold some of her land.
I'm going to have to shut Tracy down. She's too noisy.
Yeah.
I'm doing what? I'm fine.
No,
I left it.
You were rattling your hamburger papers at us.
Okay. I'm taking the red hamburger paper off. Okay, keep talking.
Okay, try to be as quiet as you can.
Okay. Don't hate, you know.
Yeah, there's things about being... I used to go to fish in Canada for a while and stop in Buffalo, and there was a Hungarian place there, and they'd bring out a big wooden platter with two of everything on it, and first time I went up there with my first wife, we cleaned the platter, and the waitress comes back and says, you know, most people don't finish those. Oh, okay. Made me ashamed of myself.
Hey, Isaac is keeping an eye on things out in the wider world while we're just sitting here chewing the fat.
I don't want to hear about Santa Claus. Just
No. This has nothing to do with Santa Claus or, you know, no, or cash machines or anything like that.
Anything, yes.
But no, this is really weird. Syria's largest city just dropped off the internet.
Uh-oh.
What?
And it's from a blog called The Switch at the Washington Post. Syria's largest city just dropped off the internet. While the U.S. government continues to weigh military intervention in Syria, it appears that Syria's largest city has gone dark on the internet. Aleppo, a city in northern Syria that has been the site of intense fighting between rebel forces and the Assad regime, and the surrounding area appear to have lost connectivity to the internet as of last night.
Well, so all I can ask all you something? Folks is, what's your opinion? What's the other side like in this rebellion?
I mean, Bob, what are these electronic forces that Syria has that's caused so much trouble with so many of our websites? What do they call them? The Electronic Army?
Yeah, the Syrian Electronic Army. They're sort of an ad hoc.
Syrian Electronic Army or some damn thing?
Yeah. And it's I guess, an ad hoc group of pro-Assad hackers.
Yeah, exactly. So apparently they can respond pretty quickly, too, with their own means. And oh, boy. I mean, if they ever get into our grid and stuff like that. I mean, war is just not what it used to be. I mean, you know, you've got cyber war now, and that's a big, 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 big theater of operation.
That's potentially more damaging than a chemical attack, is it not?
I would think so, yes, absolutely, because you're talking about power grids, you're talking about so many other functions that we depend on and using our connectivity I would definitely agree with that, sir.
And Bill, you asked a minute ago, what about the other side?
Yeah.
Well, the other side are not exactly people that we want to be putting on the Christmas card list.
No, those poor people over there can't seem to get rid of one group of creeps without getting one maybe twice as bad.
Yeah. Some of them are alleged to be Al-Qaeda aligned, although, frankly, I have no idea what that even means anymore. Because
no, it means something Fox News said.
Yeah, I mean, how many times did we kill Al-Qaeda number two?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I'll mention Fox real briefly. I had the pleasure of doing a couple of commercials for Ale when he was working here in Cleveland, and they got written up in Newsweek, not because they said, they didn't say the guy playing the harmonica stunk. It was real negative. It was real supporting Saxby when he was running for Senate. Well, they threw me $100 for 7 minutes. I wish I could do that every day, you know, as far as the money, but there, that was 1966 before the, it was a, it must have been 67. It was the 68 election, I think. That I'm not even sure. But hey, you know, you get old, you forget things.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, going back to that film Iron Sky real quick, Robert wrote in from Australia. He said, the studio footage for Iron Sky was actually shot in Australia. Don't know why. It is a great film, though. So Robert's in agreement. And yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, aside from speaking of Washington, I'm going. Miss Porter goes to Washington. Yay. So I need to know where to eat. You know, not where to what good monuments and tours. I just want to know where the food is at.
Depends on how much you want to spend.
It depends on how much I want to spend.
Now, I think one of the best food bargains in D.C., and I bet Jim knows this bookstore, there's a bookstore called Kramer's Books.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And in the back of Kramer's Books is a place called the Afterwards Cafe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go there.
And there is not a plate on that menu more than $22, and it is the best cuisine-level dining experience in D.C., in my opinion.
Okay.
Of course, you know, if you want the dress up and go eat beef experience, the Palm in
I could just go eat beef here.
Yeah,
and I don't do that here.
You know, there's a great little local chain in D.C. that's actually owned by some hillbillies, West Virginia folks, called Matchbox Cafe.
Okay.
And there's two or three of those around D.C. There's one on Barracks Row, and there's another one in Chinatown. They do wood-fired pizza oven pizzas, and then they also do cuisine-level cooking that's really yummy. They do a baked lobster mac and cheese to die
what?
For.
Baked lobster mac and cheese. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, because I get in late Friday the 13th.
But there are two places, one's called Union Market and the other one is called Eastern Market. I'm more familiar with Eastern Market. But there's a lunch counter in there, that has the best crab cake on the planet.
Okay.
And a crab cake sandwich that's magnificent. They do a fried fish sandwich, that's, you know, really, really fresh coming out of, coming out of the local fisheries. Randy in PA pointing out, what about Ben's Chili Bowl? Yeah, you kind of got to go to Ben's Chili Bowl, Tracy.
Look, Ben's Chili Bowl, and what else?
Well, Ben's Chili Bowl's it's historic and iconic too, because that was the place where people agreed not to burn it down in order to achieve some level of normalcy during the riots, yeah, the late 60s. It's iconic, and you get there. It's a hot dog, but it's a local product called a half smoke, and it's pretty awesome. And they do their own chili. It's a real big deal.
So where else? Where was the crab cakes?
Crab cakes are at the Eastern Market. Now, but they're, you know, they close by like 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Are they open on Sundays?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Hell, I think they're open for breakfast on Sundays.
I know where we're going for brunch on Sunday.
But, I mean, it's nothing fancy. It is a lunch counter.
No. See, sweetie, you know, you've listened to the food that I eat. I go to off the, you know, hole in the walls. I mean, hell, I eat a deep-fried shrimp taco off of a taco truck. Come on.
Let me throw this at you then. Sunday afternoon, after 4:30 p.m.
Okay.
There's over on Barracks Row, and I know this area because it's pretty near to where we operate. But after 4:30 p.m. is oyster happy hour at a place called Sennert's Oyster House.
Oh, you lost me. I don't do oysters.
Oh, see, this is the time to learn.
Oh, okay, oysters.
Yeah, I mean, raw. What? No.
Okay.
No, you. Yeah.
So where am I going? Because my mom and my sister like oysters.
Barracks Row.
Slide right down your throat.
But Jim, you know how they always serve them with the lemon wedges and the and the cocktail sauce?
Yes, sir.
These things are so fresh out of the, you know, sloughs and backwaters of the
Chesapeake.
Of the Chesapeake. I mean, they're not 20 hours out of the water.
Right.
And they'll sit there and describe them to you like you describe fine wines. You know, this one's more earthy. This one has a metallic quality. This one's more sane. Thing is, they'll bring you that cocktail sauce, but I've never had it this way anywhere else except Sennert's. They do this red wine vinaigrette with minced shallots and tarragon.
My
God Almighty!
And I can take an oyster and put it in a shot glass of that stuff and just throw it back.
I tell you, Bob, you're a brave man.
Yeah.
You are.
I tried that once in my life, and I thought I was gonna croak.
Now, where was the lobster mac and cheese?
Across the street from the oyster house.
And then, what's the name of that joint?
Matchbox.
See, here's the thing. I mean, I'm already pissed off that I can't go do a tour of the White House because of the fucking sequester. You know, isn't that amazing how, you know, we get a black president and I can't go into the White House so I can see the black president. I mean, I'm not going to see him, but just the fact that I can't go there and go inside the White House is really pissing me the fuck off. But that's okay. At least I get to take a picture of it and whatnot and so forth. But this whole sequester, I thought, you know, enough already. Oh, happy news. Have you heard, you know, I'm hearing the polling, the latest polling in Kentucky, that our girl is kind of hedging ahead of Mitch Maternal McConnell?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's having a hard time of it.
I mean, her, and who's the girl in Virginia? There's another lady in Virginia. What's her name?
Oh, that I don't have off the top of my head.
Okay. But maybe if we get people in there that might want to work and do our, you know, and take care of the country like we were elected to do, maybe we might get some shit done. I don't know. But how the fuck is the White House, you know, you can't even go see the White House because of this bullshit?
Is that still on, though? I thought they took care of that.
I called the hotline. It's still on.
Well, my problem is, Tracy, that the older I get, the more it looks, when I listen to Dr. Bill's constitutional speeches, educational stuff, I begin to think I spent my life living in dreamland.
Yeah, I mean, Tracy, have you taken any time to listen to Dr. Bill?
You know, I haven't, but I will now that I'm going to be working more. Where do I hear him?
Well, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, he comes on right before me, 2 hours.
Okay.
But if you go over to White Rose Society, he's got his own subdomain there, and you just get the podcast feed, and boom, there you go.
Because okay. I've been hearing about him, and I know I need to, especially since I have decided to go back to school to get my master's in clinical psychology. Yeah. I'm going to be a therapist. I don't know if that's a good thing.
Sounds good to me.
With an emphasis in gay and queer counseling.
Excellent.
Have you ever heard of Antioch University?
Antioch? Yeah, I have.
Well, that's where I'm going to be going.
Where is that?
Well, they have campuses, a few campuses, but the one I'm going to obviously is in Culver City, is out here in L.A.
Okay, I was kind of hoping it was going to be Lompoc. I just like saying Lompoc. Lompoc has been funny to me since the very first time that I saw W.C. Fields as the bank dick.
what's cool is that it's a progressive university, and they have all sorts of stuff like, you know, gay queer studies, social justice. But you know me, I'm the rabble rouser. I said, so where are the women study? Where are the women at? You know, oh, we don't have that yet. I'm like, really? I said, what about ethnic studies? Really? No. I said, so how are you calling yourself progressive? That's what always tickles me. When people label themselves or their institutions or their groups as progressive and inclusive.
Yeah, but Tracy, if you start marching your way through Dr. Bill, especially the programs of the last, 3 weeks, guys?
Yeah.
You're going to find out where the word progressive comes from. And you're going to find out where the word populist comes from.
Okay.
And you're not going to feel so good about being so progressive.
Well, Dr. Bill surprised the hell out of me in his attitude towards Ted Roosevelt. I was a little taken aback by that.
How so, Bill?
Well, because Theodore Roosevelt, he liked his wars.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
San Juan Hill, you know.
Oh, I mean, and Dr. Bill doesn't excuse that kind of stuff. He just, you know, he accepts it for what it was, but
him and the place had a lot to do with it, yeah.
Yeah, and the paternalism that, and he and Professor Keith talked a lot about that during the Prism Chat series. The paternalism that attaches to that is just gagging. But the fact of the matter is, Dr. Bill explains that progressivism is a corporate response to populism, whereby the yearnings of people for a more fair, less brutal system were co-opted by the corporations and turned into progressivism, which is Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
to pull the teeth of people who wanted to create real change in this country, to wit, the populists.
And there's things you're either never taught about or you forget about that. In this book, The Castles of Steel, which was about the First World War, the German high seas fleet and the British fleet, and he meant the guy that, toward the end of the thing, the guy mentions the fact that Dewey, Admiral Dewey, great Manila Bay victor, caught somebody sleeping. But he was faced off against the German fleet at one point. In the late 18, you know, in the 1890s, the Germans had their eyes on the Philippines. They were going to put one of their crown princes in there to run the show. There's, you know, these late arriving, I've had a lot of nations that arrive late in Europe, and of course, Japan.
Well, Germany and Japan both did. Actually, Germany even beyond Japan, because they had, you know, they were sort of left out of the race of colonialism because they weren't even a nation until 1870.
Well, my mother's father's father, my great maternal great grandfather, he fought in one war against Denmark, one against Austria, and when they were gearing up to fight that Franco-Prussian war, he gathered up his family and his wife and got the hell out of there and came and ended up living west of Cleveland at one point. My grandfather, you lived through two of these messes. A third one doesn't look so good.
During the formation of the German Empire.
Yeah, well, you know, didn't Bismarck institute Social Security in Germany in the 1870s or 80s?
Yes, well, pensions, did. Yeah.
Pensions, yeah.
He did. He said...
Must have been a communist, huh?
No. He was a pragmatist. And he said, if you're the working man's care when he is old and maintenance when he's sick, then the socialists will sing their bird call in vain. And
that's pretty nearly a quote, too.
Yeah, exactly. That's what he said. He was expressive. And, of course, he and the new Kaiser in 1890, that Kaiser, I think his father died of throat cancer after just being on the throne very, very shortly. That's when Kaiser Wilhelm II came on. And we all knew what types of psychological problems he had because mainly, I think, maybe if William had been born with two good arms, he wouldn't have been.
Yeah, possible, yeah.
He might not have been so psychologically and to do the stuff he did. He could be pretty mean. And then at the same time, the Kaiser could be very progressive. I mean, he was very progressive in many aspects. And then
when that war started, the English, the French, the Russians, and the Americans had more submarines than the Germans had.
Yeah, they did. And the Germans basically had to, well, they did a lot of damage there. As a matter of fact, I just saw something today about how the
Well, they never really wanted to risk that high seas fleet, you know.
Well, no. He wanted to keep that in Kiel, and they only at one time, and that was at the Battle of Jutland.
Jutland, yeah.
And that's
they actually attacked the and those damn Zeppelins. I didn't realize until I read this book, Castles of Steel, the Zeppelins were dropping bombs in World War One.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
And the British built an aircraft carrier, for crying out loud. They took an old ship and they put a flat top deck on it, and they could fly a biplane off of it.
Hell, the launch pad was welded onto the guns of the ship.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, to give them a flat surface which to land and stuff like that. It's just amazing how primitive it was, and then they realized how it would be very important to have aerial, you know, an air arm. And. And then, of course, I think the British started strapping bombs onto the wings, and they had six on each.
Strap on? What?
Like that.
Crazy. bad cab driver. Bad.
Yeah. I'll just put it this way. If we had spent money and the brain power on other things, you know, which we did for years, guys would invent this and that and the other thing, and I think television was ready for action before 1940.
They had television at the 1936 Olympic Games.
Yeah.
In Berlin. And they had horse shows and stuff like that that they used to broadcast at designated stations where you could actually see at the Nazi Berlin Olympic Games TV, and people could watch.
Yeah, that footage plays a central role in the film version of the Carl Sagan novel, Contact.
Mm-hmm.
When the
novel too.
Yeah, when the message bounces back from the intelligent life form out in the universe somewhere, the first thing they see is this swastika coming into focus, and their first thought is that they've just run into the intergalactic Nazis.
Uh-huh.
But it's actually the first piece of video that would be floating around in the universe is Hitler opening the 36 games.
Exactly. The first Olympic games of the modern era. That was quite a spectacle on that, and I've always been a real sort of 1936 Olympic freak, and have gathered just about everything I can, you know, to in pictures and things of that nature of how the Nazis laid it out. I mean, they really went to all ends to make that thing a show. I mean, they built that beautiful Olympic Stadium, which is still there, but it's been remodernized. And
he always came in and kicked their asses. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, when Hitler and the German army re-entered the Rhineland, the officers were carrying orders that if anybody stood up against them, to get the hell back when they went in there.
Yeah,
the French had made a move on them. They were supposed to get out of the way.
They were ordered to withdraw if they made any type of armed resistance. But, you know, I remember seeing the Olympic Bell when I was in Berlin in the late 60s, early 70s, and it's still there. And on inscribed of the bell is "I summon the youth of the world," and then there's a hole where a Soviet round went through it. But I mean, when they cast that bell and brought it into the stadium, it was a big, big, big thing. If you ever have any chance to see Olympia or any of the things that Leni Riefenstahl did, it will tell you how impressive these spectacles were, and they really put on a magnificent show at the 11th Olympiad. Of course, yeah, mind you, all the anti-Jewish stuff had been taken down, and for the first time in years, well, since Hitler became chancellor, they allowed foreign newspapers to be there and things of that nature. And I can remember a friend of my mother's who actually went to the Olympic Games in Berlin and I used to talk to her about that, and that's the sort of kind of stuff she relayed to me.
Hey, gang, as we wind down toward the end of the program, because it's about 13 minutes before the hour, first of all, let me wonderful conversation this evening. This has been more free-flowing and fun. I think it confirms the idea, don't you, Duncan, that you know, we really should kind of carve this in stone for every Friday, don't you?
As long as you're here, Bob.
Hey, don't make that sound so dire, Duncan.
Well, my computer.
Well, you said there was no show next Friday.
Well, yeah, I mean, right.
This group gets together every Friday, whether we
fact of the matter is, we could talk about this if you guys want to do it. There's no way to take calls, of course, through the traditional telephone line, but if you guys would like to do a Friday on the front porch next week in my absence, and you'd like to lead it, Duncan, I think it would be a heck of a good time. What I'm saying is I'll show you how to get the stream out.
It wouldn't be the same without you, Bob.
Well, Bob, because you bring us back in, because I tend to bring up something that fits sideways with what we're talking about, and from a historic angle. And
yeah, this will be our last Friday on the front porch for at least a couple of weeks, because I'll be gone to Wisconsin next week and the week following. This has been an excellent conversation this evening, and a lot of fun, wide ranging, kind of all over the place. The way it is when neighbors gather on the porch at the end of a long and busy week. But with the idea of ending on a high note or a happy note, I really love this story. Lottie mentioned it in the chat room a little bit earlier. This weekend, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is 80 years old, will preside at the first same-sex marriage ceremony in Washington, D.C., where it is quite legal. Justice Ginsburg is going to preside over the wedding of Kennedy Center President Michael M. Kaiser to economist John Roberts this coming set tomorrow. And that's a beautiful thing. And this is one of those more gentle moments with the goddess of irony. John Roberts is marrying Michael Kaiser, and it's not the Supreme Court justice. Help but think that Justice Ginsburg looked and said, "Wait, John Roberts? Oh, hell yes, I'm presiding over this wedding."
I have to do this one.
Speaking of marriage, you guys, I'm getting married, right? Okay.
I have that sick sense of humor that you get when you grow up in the 50s and 60s. Hell, gay marriage? Absolutely. Sure should. You know, got to pay a lawyer like everybody else when you want to get out of it, you know?
Yeah, it's good for business.
It's the American way, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just impossible that every marriage will work out. So a new market has expanded, and the business of America is business. And to the extent that there is gay marriage, there will, as sure as the sun rises in the east, be gay divorces.
Sure.
Absolutely.
But my problem in old age is sitting about all the women that got away from me in my life. You know, when you're playing a goddamn band in the 60s and 70s, my God. I look in the mirror and say, how'd you meet all those people, Bill?
Think of the profits that the florists are going to make. They're really going to like a lot of flowers.
It's good for, I mean, marriage is great for business, you know?
And so is divorce. I mean, listen, when you're a divorce lawyer and your slogan is, lose 300 pounds of ugly fat, does divorces, you know, that's gender nonspecific.
Yes.
I like the one down here in Florida, is divorce without war.
Well, that's a good idea.
Well, that's a good thing, because so many divorces do have so many internecine quarrels and things like that that are really horrible.
Well, I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg's comments on why she is officiating at this wedding tomorrow are especially telling. She said, "I think it will be one more statement that people who love each other and want to live together should be able to enjoy the blessings and the strife in the marriage relationship. It won't be long before there will be another.
Yeah, well, strife's always been there, and then love, but now, now I can actually do all those things that people were being deprived of because of it. All the little fringe side insurances and this and that, and God bless it all. I mean,
inheritance, you name it.
Inheritance, yes. Always
pensions.
There's always somebody who'll try to stick their foot in it and try to mess up somebody else's situation.
You all sound so cynical about the whole enterprise, or that actually is an enterprise, because that's what a marriage contract is.
Larry, it's not entirely cynicism, it's realism.
Yeah.
I mean, not all marriages work.
That's true. 50% of them don't work today in this country.
Most marriages that end within the first 5 years.
Yeah, I was 10 and 12, so I did something right somewhere along the line.
I think I'm almost 15 years into mine, and I'm struggling to keep it going.
Well, I was getting old to my second one. You know, I had a heart attack early in life, and that's, my God, he's going to take off, and, you know, and he's going to leave me and go up and see the man upstairs. Well, she should have been more worried about me going to see somebody else, that's for sure.
I know my parents told me that they were married in 1936, and my dad said if we hadn't had two bathrooms, we'd have been divorced long ago.
Sometimes it was just a strange... Jim, I don't know, I think you're old enough to have lived through that revolution. I tell people, man, when I was a kid, when that sexual revolution merry-go-round started turning, man... You didn't know whether to jump on or get the hell out of the way.
Well, you had to be a very accomplished horseman, let me tell you that. And and have a very, very secure seat in the saddle.
Well, hey, and one other thing before we wrap up. This is a long holiday weekend. The horn will not be live Monday night. Hopefully we'll be spending some family time. But it is not just any holiday. This is a holiday that I reserve real reverence for. This is Labor Day. This is the holiday occasioned by the sacrifices made at places like Haymarket.
Mm-hmm. And 1886 in Chicago.
And the Battle of Blair Mountain, 1921 in West Virginia, Larry.
Thank you.
This is the time when we honor the people who built this country, i.e. working people, not the coupon clipping class.
And so, arguments I have with my supervision.
Horse and rider metaphor.
I'm just glad I don't have to work the Labor Day picnic anymore. I did it 15 years.
And part of the reason I brought it up, Duncan, is to just offer my admiration for you, for Jason, for Boss Man Wayne, who made all of this happen to begin with, mm-hmm. and continues to work tirelessly, even after a damn near fatal heart attack, is back out there pounding the bricks, working for workers in this state, and every other member of every other union, who's out there trying, because it is labor, whatever its faults may be, and there are faults, and I think even union members will say, oh yeah, we got problems, but whatever faults they are far outweighed by the manifest tremendous good that they have done in this country over the course of the last century and a half.
Here.
And you know, the fact that there's a weekend at one point in time before the advent of the work week in a steel mill in Pittsburgh was 96 hours. That was 80, maybe 84 hours, something like that. That was the regular work week.
Yeah, 12-hour day, 6-hour week.
Yeah.
I mean, 6-day week. Yeah,
right.
Pretty bad.
Well, I had the pleasure of being a member of the ILGW and the Teamsters and the AF of M.
so.
Yeah.
Three of them.
And
myself and Jason are members of the IBEW.
Yeah, and I'll drink a beer there tonight, although I wish that we were moving forward instead of backwards, because corporate America is beating the shit out of us.
Well, they have, I'll tell you, there are morons that are convinced that everybody who joined the union's a thug. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I remember when they used to call Boss Man Wayne a thug on that crappy little radio station in Beckley.
I was a union organizer for 3 years, and I got called all kinds of names.
But my reverence and admiration goes out to everyone. I wish, you know, one of the things, and we got to get out of here, but one of the things that attended the origins of the horn was that we were going to, you know, we were going to build something that was sustainable, and, you know, we were going to, and it was going to be a union shop. And it, unfortunately, it never came to fruition. God knows, I wish it had. You know, hell, I'd have health care now if it had. But, you know, that's the way some things work out. And in addition to mentioning other people, of course, immediately after this program follows Rick Smith, who is the brilliant expositor of the things that make labor and unions great, and how those unions have made this country great, that this country has going right now. I remember that of the newer crop of progressive or liberal or whatever we're calling ourselves talkers, Rick Smith is the very best. So with all that having been said, everybody have a happy Labor Day weekend. Lift a glass to those who have made this country far better than it ever was before. And y'all have a wonderful weekend, and time to check out.
Just thanks to all you, because I never get a chance to talk to everybody at once, and it sure was fun. Thank you.
Yeah, good night.
Y'all take care.
Quite a blast.
You too, Bob. And by the way, you're only going to get bigger.
That's true.
It would be fun. Y'all be well. Have a great
weekend.
Have a
good night, everyone.
Give it time, bro.
Likewise. All right, Jason.
So that's the close of the program for this evening. Quickly running out of time. Rick Smith is next. Happy Labor Day, everyone. Catch you Tuesday.